in an official way, Dr. John Polkinghorne, to thank him for making that long trip from Cambridge, England. It wasn't without some change of plans because his wife Ruth could not accompany him. They had planned on taking a trip to Alaska last week, and it was the one trip that was canceled. If any of you were in the Northwest, you knew that there was one trip, and that was the one they had decided on. But they will do it in the future, and we will welcome you back, John, again into the Northwest. John has had a long career as a theoretical elementary particle physicist. And from 1968 to 1979, he held the chair of mathematical physics at Cambridge University. He then resigned to train for the Anglican priesthood and was ordained in 1982. After some years in parish life, he returned to Cambridge, and from 1989 to 1996, he was president of Queen's College in Cambridge. He was elected a fellow of the Royal Society, the British National Academy of Science in 1974, and knighted by the Queen in 1997. He is the author of many books on science and religion. His most recent writings include The Faith of a Physicist, by Fortress, 94, Belief on God in an Age of Science, Yale University Press, in 98, Science and Theology, by Fortress, in 98, and Faith, Science, and Understanding, again, a Yale University Press publication in the year 2000. John has three children, as we became acquainted in our travels. Several are in England, and one is in, it was Australia, wasn't it, John, that you said? And so that gives him and Ruth a chance to visit. He's busy. He's a horticulturist, a gardener, enjoys being in creation. He's also served, I didn't exactly get the name, John, but a national committee in England in the area of stem cell research, and what that means, and some of the implications of that. He's worked closely with a familiar name in this country, Ted Peters, and others who are thinking about that, not only practically, but theologically. But what a delight it is to have him on this side of the world for a few days up here at Holden Village. And let's give a warm Holden welcome to John Polkinghorne.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. Before I begin, I'd just like to say this. All of us in Britain were greatly shocked and deeply saddened by the events of the 11th of September, and the American people have been very much in our thoughts and prayers since that time, and it's therefore a privilege for me to be with you. I want to talk now about how science looks at the world. I want to try and, in this talk, to describe the scientific perspective on the universe in which we live, to suggest that there are some quite striking features of that, features which call for an explanation that will go beyond what science itself can furnish, and to suggest that a theological response to those questions is one that is both coherent and, in my view, attractive. So what can I tell you about the universe? Well, the first thing I think I want to say is it's bigger than theologians think, and it's been around for longer than theologians think. When theologians talk about the world, they usually mean this little planet Earth, you know? And the universe is really much bigger than that. Our local star, the Sun, just a pretty ordinary star, among the 100,000 million stars of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And our galaxy is nothing much to speak about among the 100,000 million galaxies of the observable universe. So we are the inhabitants of a speck of cosmic dust. And when theologians talk about history, they usually have in mind the, let's say, well, to be generous, let's say 10,000 years of human cultural history. Recorded history, of course, is less than that. But we know, of course, that the universe has been around from about 13 to 15 billion years from its fiery appearance in the Big Bang. So there's a bigger story to tell. And that's not one of the first things we have to take on board. The second thing I want to tell you is that scientists are deeply struck. But when I say scientists, I'm a physicist myself, and I'm particularly influenced, obviously, by my experience as a physicist. And we are deeply impressed by the intelligibility, the rational transparency of the world in which we live. I don't know if you've ever stopped to ask yourself the question, why is science possible at all? Why is it that we can understand the world in which we live? Now, of course, obviously, we've got to understand the world in some sort of everyday sense. There is an evolutionary survival necessity to make sense of everyday experience. If we couldn't figure out that it's a bad idea to step off the top of a high cliff, then we wouldn't be around for very long, particularly in this part of the world, I have to say. So there's a certain sort of rough and readiness. But our powers to understand the world very greatly exceed anything that could conceivably be connected with just everyday survival. I worked as a quantum physicist, the subatomic world of quantum theory. That world is totally different from the world of everyday. In the quantum world, if you know where an electron is, you don't know what it's doing. If you know what it's doing, you don't know where it is. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, in a nutshell. That world is not picturable to us, but it turns out that we can understand it. And similarly, we can understand the vast expanses of cosmic space, the curved space of the universe in which we live. That's a very striking fact about the world. And it makes science possible. Perhaps you know that Einstein once said that the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Why is it we are able to understand it? Not just in that everyday way, but in that deep, profound, and extensive way. The world is open to our understanding. I'll come back to that, but I just want to set the scene again. And the fact that we understand the world is even more remarkable than I've said already, because not only is the universe rationally transparent to us, but it's also rationally beautiful. And the key to unlocking the secrets of the universe turns out to be mathematics. Now, that's a very striking fact about the world. It's an actual technique in fundamental physics. If you're looking for a new theory, to look for a theory whose mathematical expression will be characterized by beautiful equations. Some of you will know about mathematical beauty. Possibly not all of you will know about mathematical beauty. It's a rather abstract form of aesthetic pleasure, but it's a real form of aesthetic pleasure, and moreover, it's something that we mathematicians can agree about. We can really say, yeah, that is really beautiful. And we have found time and again in the history of physics that it's only equations that have that unmistakable character of mathematical beauty that turn out to be the ones that actually are fruitful and continue to explain the processes of the world in which we live. So if you've got a friend who's a theoretical physicist, and you want to upset him or her, you just say to them, that latest theory of yours looks rather ugly and contrived to me. And they're going to be pretty upset, I can tell you about that. Now, when we use mathematics in that sort of way, something really very strange is happening. Because you see, what's mathematics? Mathematics is, if you like, the abstract, rational exploration of the human mind. It's something that we do as we sit and think in our studies. What I'm saying to you is that some of the most beautiful patterns that the mathematicians can think about, and mathematics isn't your subject, just think of it as being a pattern-creating, pattern-analyzing subject. What I'm saying to you is some of the most beautiful patterns the mathematicians can think about are found actually to occur in the structure of the world around us. In other words, there's some sort of deep-seated connection between the reason within, in this case, our mathematical thinking, and the reason without, the rational order of the world in which we live. That's very odd. What ties them together? A pretty celebrated theoretical physicist, he won a Nobel Prize for physics, called Eugene Wigner, once said, "Why is mathematics so unreasonably effective? Why is it the key to unlock the secrets of the universe?" He didn't answer his question, but he said, "It is a gift," he said, "that we neither understand nor deserve." I don't know whether we deserve it. I rather think as a mathematician we do deserve it, but I would also like to understand it. And that again is a question to which I will return. I'm going to do the science first and not try and mix up things too much. So we live in a world that's rationally beautiful, rationally transparent and intelligible to us. We also, and this is a very surprising discovery that I'm sure many of you will know about, but we've only come to realize in the last 30, 40 years that we live in a universe also that's very special, a very particular sort of universe. Now that was a really upsetting thought to physicists. See, scientists don't like things to be special. We like things to be general. We like to talk about things in general. And our natural inclination was to think we live in a pretty common or garden sort of universe, just a typical sort of universe that you might get off the shelf in the universe shop. But we found that that isn't the case, that the universe in which we can live is a very particular universe, a very finely tuned universe, you might say. The laws of nature in this world have to be very precisely what they are for the possibility of carbon-based life to appear in the history of the universe. I'm going to talk about history. Of course, it's been an evolving history, and I'm going to talk about those sort of matters tomorrow. But we realize that evolution is half the story. And evolution, the evolutionary process, by itself would have been incapable of producing any form of life, let alone the very complex and remarkable sort of life that human beings are, if the physical fabric, the given physical fabric of the world, had not been already finely tuned to that possibility. As far as we know, life appeared in the universe when it was about 11 billion years old, here on Earth, of course, maybe elsewhere. The beginning. It was built in, the potentiality for carbon-based life was built into the given physical fabric of the world. The laws of nature had to be exactly what they are, if that was to be a possibility. That's a surprising discovery that I'd like to explain a little bit to you why we think that that's the case. You see, of course, I mean, what does it mean? Well, it means this. Of course, we only directly know the universe in which we live. But we scientific people are imaginative in our way, and with our imaginations we can visit other universes that are like ours, but are different in some particularity, some particular detail. For example, let me give you an example of that. We live in a world that, of course, has gravity in it. And not just any old gravity, a particular form for gravity. It's an inverse square law, essentially, which Newton discovered. And gravity has a particular strength in our world. In fact, it may surprise you if you're not a physicist to learn that of the intrinsic forces of nature, gravity is far and away the weakest of all the forces of nature. Very, very weak indeed. That would be an odd thought on the way down from the top of that high cliff. But it's true all the same. And the reason the high cliff is dangerous is that gravity only comes in one kind. And so it all adds up. Nothing cancels it out. And that's what makes the high cliff dangerous. There are other forces of nature. For example, there's electromagnetism. Now that's the force of nature that holds matter together. The benches on which you're sitting are held together by electromagnetism. You are held together by electromagnetism. Now electromagnetism is a much, much stronger force than gravity. But of course, as you all know, it comes in two kinds, positive and negative. And they tend to cancel each other out over any distance. And that's why we're not so directly aware of electromagnetism in the way that we are aware of gravity. So that's what I mean by the physical fabric of the world. We have certain laws of nature, they have a certain shape to them, a certain form to them, and they have a certain intrinsic strength that's connected to them. Now let us, in our imagination, visit a world that is almost the same as the universe in which we live. It has just the same laws of nature, with one single exception. I'm going to have electromagnetism the same, and things like that, but I'm going to change gravity. And in that world, I'm going to have gravity a little bit stronger than it is in our universe. For definiteness, and also to make the calculations come out easy, I'm going to make it 3 times stronger than it is in our universe. That's the only change. Everything else is the same. Now, I don't know what you'd have guessed, but I would have guessed that if I could persuade God to bring into being that world, with that slight difference, if I had a few billion years to spare to watch its history, then I would expect it to have been able to develop its own form of life. Obviously not human beings, little green men maybe. And actually they would be little green men, because if gravity is stronger, it would be harder to grow tall in that world. So the inhabitants of that world would be expected to be rather squat. But in fact, there would be no inhabitants in that world at all. That single change would have rendered its history boring and sterile. What would have gone wrong? Well, what would have gone wrong with this? When you're designing a universe, one of the, to be a fruitful universe, to have life in it, one of the things you really, really got to get right is to get the stars right, because the stars have very important roles to play in the fruitfulness of a universe. And one of the simplest roles they have to play is the role that our sun has been playing for about 5 billion years, which is simply to provide the energy that will fuel the development of life on one of its planets. If you're going to have that happen, you've got to have a star that's going to burn, first of all, pretty steadily. Mustn't have it sort of flaring up or dropping down, because if it flares up, it'll burn life to a frazzle. If it drops down, it'll freeze it to death. So it's got to burn fairly steadily and for long times, because the development of life takes a while, particularly the development of complex life as you and me takes a while. It's not an accident that life has been going on in Earth about 3.5 to 4 billion years. It takes that time for it to happen. So you've got to have long-lived, steadily burning, reliable stars. We actually call them main sequence stars in the trade. Now we understand what makes those most stars behave in that way. We understand the burning of stars pretty well, and it turns out at the end of the day that it depends upon a very delicate, very sensitive balance between two of the forces of nature, in fact, between gravity and electromagnetism. And the way the stars burn depends upon exactly how that balance is struck. And because it's a very sensitive dependence, my making gravity 3 times stronger would have substantially changed the way the stars burn in that other world. They would burn much, much more intensely than they do in this universe. In fact, they would just pour out energy and they would burn themselves out in a mere few million years. After that, they would be cinders. Our sun has been burning, as I say, for about 5 billion years, and it'll burn, you'll be glad to know, for about another 5 billion years after that, which will see you and me out as far as things are concerned. So what would have gone wrong in that world would have been that the stars would have been unable to fuel the development of life. Before any time for anything interesting had happened, the world would have gone dead and dark. So you've got to be careful. There's another thing that stars have to do. They have to make the chemical raw materials of life. The very early universe is very simple. And the very early universe, because it's very, very simple, it's essentially an almost uniform expanding ball of energy, which is just about the simplest physical system you can think about. Because it's very simple in that way, it only does very simple things, and it only makes the two simplest chemical elements. The very early universe, 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when things settled down a bit, was 3/4 hydrogen and 1/4 helium, the two simplest elements. And they have a very boring chemistry. You can't do anything very much with them. The chemistry of life is the chemistry of carbon. So where's carbon going to come from? It's actually, you need about 30 elements for life, but carbon is one of the central essential elements. Where's the carbon going to come from? Well, there's only one place in the whole universe where carbon can be made, and that's in the nuclear furnaces of the stars. Every atom of carbon inside your body was once inside a star. We are creatures of stardust. We are made from the ashes of dead stars. Now, one of the great triumphs of the second half of the 20th century, as far as astrophysics was concerned, was to figure out how the elements, the chemical elements, are made inside the star. And when people began to think about that, they got stuck at absolutely the first stage. You see, they've got helium. We call the nucleus of helium an alpha particle. And carbon, the carbon nucleus consists of three alpha particles stuck together. So how are you going to make that happen? Well, the natural way of making it happen is first of all to stick two of them together. That makes beryllium. And then wait a bit and bang, another one collides, and you stick a third one on and you've got carbon. Simple, you might think, but unfortunately not. Because it turns out that beryllium is very, very unstable. It doesn't stay around for very long. So you don't have time to stick a third alpha particle onto it before it disappears. So how could you get carbon? And the people who were thinking about this were absolutely baffled by that. They couldn't see how to do it. And then a senior colleague of mine in Cambridge, a chap called Fred Hoyle, suddenly saw there was just one way in which it might happen. It's very, very hard to make three things stick together through collisions. But there is just one way in which you can do it if there is an enhancement effect. In the trade, we call it a resonance. And if it's going to make those three alphas stick together and make carbon 12, that resonance has got to be absolutely at a precise energy. It's got to be exactly the right energy to hold the three alphas together and make the carbon. And Fred saw that was the only way in which carbon could be made inside the star. Now, he looked at the tables that tell you about how nuclei behave and see whether there was a resonance there, and energy there wasn't. But he felt so confident that this was the only way it could happen that he said to his friends, actually at Caltech, the Lauritsens, he said, go and have a look, and you'll find there is a resonance there. And he told them exactly where to look, because he knew that this energy had to be fine-tuned to just that possibility. And they looked, and it was there. That's the fine-tuning of the universe. And it's because of that that you and I are here today as specimens, interesting specimens of carbon-based life. Now, Fred's always been rather against religion. But when he saw that fine-tuning, he said in a Yorkshire accent that it's beyond my powers to imitate, he said, the universe is a put-up job. In other words, this can't be just an accident. There must be something going on here. Well, we'll come back to that too. So we live in a world that's very special, very finely tuned to the possibility of life. The fourth thing I want to say about the world in which we live is that it is a relational universe in which we live. If we go back to the beginnings of modern science, we go back to Isaac Newton, Cambridge man, of course, the Newtonian picture of the physical world was that space was a sort of container, and into that container you put atoms, corpuscles Newton called them, put in atoms that are just sort of billiard ball things, maybe with hooks on them to make them stick together, and they sort of rattle around inside this container. That's a very unrelational world. It's a world that's made up of a conglomeration of bits and pieces rattling around in the container of space. But 20th century science has totally changed that sort of picture. And we've come to realize that the world, the universe in which we live, is deeply interrelational in its character. The first way in which we realized that was through a great discovery by Albert Einstein. Most of us would think Einstein's very greatest discovery. It's called general relativity, and it's the modern theory of gravity. I'd love to tell you more about it, but I won't take time to describe general relativity. But Einstein saw that space and time and matter, which in Newtonian terms would be three quite independent and separate things, that space and time and matter are in fact intimately connected together. It's a sort of package deal. If you're going to think about the universe in which we live, you have to think space, time, matter. In the Einsteinian universe, space is curved, and it's matter that curves space. The reason that we keep going around the sun is that the sun curves the space in which we're moving. And because the space is curved, that changes the way in which the matter of the Earth moves. So space, time, and matter are intimately linked to each other in the single package deal of general relativity. We live in a world of integrated relationships. And that's even true at the subatomic level, at the level of particle physics. I worked in elementary particle physics for about 25 years, and in some ways that's a very bits and pieces subject. I mean, you take things apart to try and find out what they're made of. From the point of view of an elementary particle physicist, you people are just very complicated. I have to admit, there's very complicated collections of quarks and the particles that make the quarks stick together, which are called gluons, I'm afraid, in the relentlessly jokey terminology of my subject. So it's a very sort of reductionist bits and pieces subject, but it turns out that nature fights back. And there is an effect in the subatomic world which tells us that even subatomic particles, even quantum entities like electrons or whatever it may be, are not just bits and pieces independent of each other. They're in some deep way entangled with each other. There's an effect called the EPR effect. The E stands for Einstein, and the P and the R stand for two young collaborators of Einstein's. One was called Podolsky and the other was called Rosen. And they saw that it was implied by a quantum theory that once two particles had interacted with each other, then they would, in some sense, retain a power to affect each other, however far they separated. They would be mutually entangled with each other and could never really get apart from each other. One might stay here, the other might go far away, beyond the moon is what we conventionally say. But if I did something to the one here in the laboratory, it would have an instantaneous effect on the one behind the moon. It wasn't just that I'd learn something about the one behind the moon, I would actually change the way it was beyond the moon by doing something here in my laboratory on the Earth. The two, in some sense, were entangled with each other, could never get apart from each other. There is a sort of built-in togetherness and separation present in the structure of nature. Einstein thought that was such a weird effect, he called it spooky, that he thought that it showed there was something wrong with quantum theory. Einstein had been the grandfather of quantum theory, but he hated his grandchild, and he was always trying to dispose of it. And he thought, gee, I've got it now, with the EPR effect, but much later, in the 1980s, a very clever experimentalist in Paris, led by somebody called Alain Aspect, did some experiments that show conclusively that this entanglement, this togetherness and separation, is a real property of the subatomic world. We live in a world that is deeply interrelated in its character. Fifth thing I want to say about the world in which we live is that we live in a world that is orderly, but nevertheless, in some sense, open. Again, that's a change from the Newtonian picture. The Newtonian picture was, of course, a picture of a tightly deterministic world, a world that you could compare in your mind to a sort of piece of gigantic cosmic clockwork. Newton himself didn't quite think that way. He was too religious a man to quite think in, naturally in those terms. But certainly Newton's successors, the great French theoretical physicist Laplace, for example, thought very much in clockwork terms about the universe. But in the 20th century, we found out that whatever the universe is, it is certainly not clockwork. 20th century science saw the death of a merely mechanical view of the world. The physical world is neither tame, nor controllable, nor in that sense, predictable and mechanical. There are intrinsic unpredictabilities present in the physical world. Not just things that we're not clever enough to figure out or not skillful enough to be able to measure, things that we can never figure out and that we can never measure, but are intrinsic unpredictabilities in the physical world. The most striking and well-known example of that is, of course, again, quantum theory. If you have a radioactive nucleus, you can say it's got a 50-50 chance, let's say, of decaying in the next hour, but you can't say whether it will decay in the next hour. That means if you've got a great chunk of matter made up of those nuclei, half of it will decay in the hour, but you can't say which are the nuclei that are going to do that and which are the ones that are going to stay unchanged. It's intrinsically unpredictable, the behavior of quantum entities. That was itself, of course, a big surprise, and again, Einstein hated it. That's one principal reason why he hated quantum theory. But we've also, as you all know, we've also discovered, and this was a really surprising discovery, 40 years ago or so, that even the everyday world, described pretty well by Newtonian physics, even that everyday world is not as tame, controllable, mechanical, predictable as we had thought it was. That's the discovery that's called chaos theory. I'll have more to say about chaos tomorrow. It's interesting that we have the theme of chaos in our worship, and I'll return to that theme from a scientific point of view tomorrow. But it turns out the Newtonian world, though it does have some clocks in it, it has robust systems that you really can know what they're going to do. I mean, those of us who learnt about it, we call Newtonian physics, we call it classical mechanics. And those of us who learnt classical mechanics, we learnt it by studying certain systems that we thought were typical, such as a steadily ticking pendulum. And that's a very robust system. If you slightly disturb a pendulum, it doesn't have much effect on how it beats. That's why pendulum clocks are a possibility. If you're slightly uncertain about how long the pendulum is, that will make you slightly uncertain about what its period will be. But these systems are mechanical, they're tame and controllable. We thought they were the typical systems of the world of classical mechanics, but it turns out they're not. There are clocks in that world, but there are also a great number of clouds. And by clouds, I mean systems that are so exquisitely sensitive to the detail of the circumstances that the slightest disturbance will totally change their future behavior. You've all heard of the butterfly effect, and you probably know that's one of the first persons to, in some sense, stumble upon the existence of these chaotic systems was a chap called Ed Lorenz, who was studying simple models of the behavior of the Earth's weather system, and who found that when he slightly changed the input to his equations, he totally changed the output. And the Earth's weather systems can be in so sensitive a state that it's a serious joke to say that a butterfly steering the air with its wings in the Central American jungle will create a storm over the Pacific Northwest in about 3 weeks' time. That's about the timescale for these things to grow and grow and grow. These small disturbances can just exponentiate, as we say in the trade, grow and grow and grow. And since we can't know about all those Central American butterflies, I can tell you, detailed long-term weather forecasting is never going to work. The world is intrinsically unpredictable in many, many ways. Now that's an interesting fact, and a very surprising fact. What do we make of it? Well, that in itself is an intriguing question, because, of course, predictability is the sort of issue that the philosophers call epistemological. It's concerned about, can we know what the future behavior of the system is going to be? But we're also interested not only in what we can know, we're also interested in what is the case. We're interested not only in epistemology, what we can know, but also in ontology, the study of what is the case, of how things actually are. And it is a celebrated problem in philosophy, and perhaps the central problem in the philosophy of science, of what is the relationship between epistemology and ontology? How is what we know related to what is the case? And that isn't actually a scientific question. That's a philosophical question. It's, if you like, a metaphysical question. And because it's a metaphysical question, it doesn't have a single unquestionable answer to it. There are people who think that what we know isn't very much related to what's the case. Immanuel Kant really took that point of view. Immanuel Kant, you remember, thought that all we observe in the world are the phenomenal shadows of things. But the noumena, the things in themselves, are unknowable to us. He thought we were lost in some sort of epistemological fog. Now, scientists don't think that. If we did think that, we wouldn't bother to do science, frankly. Doing science is hard work and frustrating and all sorts of things like that, like any other worthwhile profession. It has a lot of routine to it. And we wouldn't take all that trouble unless we thought we were really learning what the physical world is like. So scientists are not Kantians, they are realists. They believe that what we know is a reliable guide to what is the case. They believe that epistemology and ontology are somehow closely connected with each other. Now, if you don't believe that, I can't force you to believe it. It's a choice. It's a philosophical choice. But I tell you, it's a choice that almost all scientists make. Some consciously, I have to say, some unconsciously. But that's what they do. My wife gave me a sweatshirt a few years ago, which has on it a stirring motto, words that she'd often heard me utter on occasions like this. Epistemology models ontology, my sweatshirt says. You get some pretty funny looks if you get out on the street wearing it, I can tell you. I can tell you that. What it's saying is that what we know is a reliable guide to what is the case. And I believe that. And if you believe that, then you will begin to believe, I think, that the unpredictabilities of the world are not just unfortunate patches of ignorance, but they are signs actually of a degree of actual openness in the process of the world. That the death of mere mechanism is a very complete sort of death, really. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. I'll develop that theme a little bit more tomorrow. But it's an attractive notion to pursue, at least I think it is, not only because it's natural to a scientist to make that realist assumption that two fit together, but also because it begins to offer a glimmer, I don't say more than that, a glimmer of how it might be that science is able to describe a physical world of which we could conceive ourselves as being inhabitants. You see, there's always been something fishy about the clockwork universe. Because whatever certain philosophers might assure you, human beings have always known, and certainly always acted as if they knew, that we are not automata. We are able to act in the world. Of course, we are constrained by the physical nature of the world. We can't fly and things like that. But we believe ourselves, and in my view, rightly believe ourselves, to be agents, to be people who are capable of, within limits, of acting out our willed intentions. And if the world were a mechanical world, a clockwork world, we just wouldn't be recognizable as inhabitants of that world. So if science begins to open up the possibility of an openness in physical process, then that's a gain for science. We don't need quantum theory or chaos theory to tell us that we're agents. We know that already. But if science can begin to open up the possibility of a world of more open process, then that in itself will be a gain for science in the direction of describing more realistically the world in which we live. When I say open, of course, I don't mean that the future is some sort of random lottery, that the goddess Fortuna decides what's going to happen next. But what I do mean is that the causal principles that bring about the future, though they certainly include the causalities that science is able to discuss, are not exhausted by that discussion. And that there are other forms of causality that play a part in bringing about the future. And I shall argue a bit more about that tomorrow. And I've already indicated that I think human agency would be one of those principles. So there we are. You see, science gives us a picture of a world that is very rich and intriguing in its character. It is deeply intelligible. It is rationally beautiful. It is very particular. We don't live in any old world. It is relational in its character, highly interconnected, not a collection of bits and pieces. It has a deep order to it, but an order that is not a sort of prison house, an order that has about it at least the smack of an openness. It is a world, as I say, of which we can begin to conceive ourselves as being inhabitants. That's the scientific story. That's what science sees. But most of the things I've described are things that science sees but does not explain. Science may rejoice in these properties, it may exploit these properties, but it doesn't explain them. Why is the world intelligible? Why is science possible? Why is mathematics so unreasonably effective? These are deep, sensible questions to ask. And I'm not content myself with the intellectually lazy approach of simply shrugging one's shoulders and say, gee, that's the way it happens to be. And a bit of good luck for you chaps who are good at math. That seems to me to be carrying, intellectual insouciance to a ridiculous extreme. Why is the universe so special? Is it just our luck? A happy accident? Is it a sign that, in fact, there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different universes, all with different laws of nature, a vast portfolio of different cosmic worlds, and we happen to be in the one that just has the winning lottery ticket, so to speak, to allow our carbon-based life to appear within its history? Well, that's a possible explanation, but it's a pretty prodigal explanation. It's certainly not a scientific explanation. It's a metaphysical gift of very great prodigality. What I think is the case is that theistic belief provides us with not answers to the scientific questions. I think we have every reason to believe that scientifically posable questions will receive scientifically statable answers. Those answers may be very difficult to find. We don't understand, for example, really at all, in an agreed way anyway, the biochemical pathways by which life has come to be here on Earth, how it all began. I trust and hope that one day we will understand that scientifically. We've reason to think that scientifically statable questions will receive scientifically statable answers. The one God who is well and truly dead, and no one should shed a tear for his passing, and I don't need to worry what pronoun I use for him because he's not a pseudo-deity, is the God of the gap. The God who popped up as the explanation of current scientific ignorance. That God was always liable to disappear with the advance of science, always the sort of Cheshire Cat deity fading away in the advance of knowledge. That God was also a terrible theological mistake, because if there is a God, then God is the God of the whole show, and not just the cosmic stunt artist who does the difficult bits of cosmic process that are hard to understand. It's a theological mistake to think in those terms. We have every reason to think that scientifically posable questions will receive scientifically statable answers, but we equally have every reason to suppose that there are many questions that are meaningful and necessary to ask, which are not scientific in character, and to which science itself will therefore be unable to provide an answer. Science is very successful. I have not the slightest regrets having spent half my life working as a scientist. I regard it as being a Christian vocation to use my modest talents in that sort of direction. But science has purchased its great success by the modesty of its ambition. It doesn't try and ask and answer every question. And it's interesting that there are these questions, we've thought about them, which arise from our experience of doing science, but which go beyond science's self-limited power to answer. So that, for example, why is the world so deeply intelligible? Well, I believe it is because the world is a creation which has been endowed by its rational creator with an order of that character. Why is science possible? Why is mathematics so unreasonably effective? Well, I believe fundamentally that science is possible, again, because the world is a creation, and that we are creatures made in the image of our creator. I think part, it's only a small part of that, but a real part, of the imago Dei is our human ability to do science, to use mathematics to understand the structure of the world. Why is the world so special, so finely tuned to the possibility of life? Not, I think, because it's a winning ticket in that vast portfolio of different universes, but because this universe is not just any old world. It is a creation that has been endowed by its creator with precisely those finely tuned laws and circumstances that will enable it to have a fruitful history as a fulfillment of the fertile will of its creator. The relationality of the world is certainly something that is congenial to the notion that the God who is the creator of the world is the Christian God whom we know in the divine mystery of the Holy Trinity. And the doctrine of the Trinity says many things to us. One of the things it says is that reality itself is relational in its character. I'm not playing the old vestiges of the Trinity card. I'm not saying you can read these things out of nature, but I'm saying that nature is consistent with our Trinitarian Christian belief in its relationality, its deep interconnectedness. And I believe that if the world, the process of the physical world is sufficiently open for us for the other causal principles at work, other than those just described by physics, if I believe, as I do believe, that that's the way we ourselves are able to act as agents within its unfolding history, then it seems to me, unbelievable that God also interacts with that unfolding history. A world that is open to human agency must surely be open to the possibility of divine providential agency as well. And that, again, is a theme I'll return to tomorrow, and I think a lot of Well, it is not, it seems to me, unbelievable that God also interacts with that unfolding history. A world that is open to human agency must surely be open to the possibility of divine providential agency as well. And that, again, is a theme I'll return to tomorrow, and I think not about so much the state of the world, but the history of the world. So there we are. We live in an age, actually, you see, what I've been doing, as you will have perceived, is in a sense I've been doing natural theology today. I've been saying, not that we look around the universe and we see lots of things stamped made by God. I mean, God, the Creator, is a little bit more subtle than that. But I'm saying that as we study the process of the world, and when we understand, study the structure and nature of the universe in which we live, we see signs that are with insight and intellectual integrity interpretable as hints of the presence of a Creator. There is a new form of natural theology developing at the present time. It's a revised form of natural theology. It doesn't talk about proofs of God. He doesn't say to atheists, you're stupid if you don't believe in God. Our atheist friends are not stupid. But he does say a theistic belief, indeed I'd go as far as to say a Trinitarian belief, explains more. It is more deeply insightful. The appeal is not to demonstration, not to logical coercion, but to insight, to intellectual satisfaction. And I would defend the thesis, and have, with staunch atheist opponents like Stephen Weinberg and people like that, the thesis that the theism is a more comprehensive, more intellectually satisfying matrix of understanding than atheism can provide. That new natural theology is not a rival to science, it is a complement to science. I've already said it doesn't seek to answer science's own questions, it leaves that to science, it certainly couldn't do, but it answers those meta questions, those questions that go beyond science, about the intelligibility, etc., of the world, and makes them intelligible, removes them from categories of happy accident, and makes them something that we can understand. And it is actually a revived, not only a revised natural theology, but it is a revived natural theology. It's actually happening. And not just with pious scientists like me, but with people like, for example, Paul Davis. I'm sure many of you will know some of Paul's writings. He's a very interesting chap. He stands outside any faith tradition, and has, I think, very little understanding of what faith traditions are up to. But nevertheless, from the sort of considerations we've been thinking about, he feels there's something going on here. There's more than has met the eye of science. In his even more curious way, Fred Hoyle, with his feeling that the universe is a put-up job and there's some sort of intelligence behind it all, is moving in that direction. Of course, these considerations are only a part of what we believe to be the revealed nature of our Creator and our Redeemer. The God of natural theology is not the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, but it's a step in the right direction. It puts the theistic question onto the agenda. And I think that science, in that sense, is hospitable and encouraging to the defense of theism in our age. I'll finish there, and perhaps we can have a little bit of conversation before it's supper time.